The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today we are going to be on all of our stations for different periods of time. For those who are listening on WMYE in New York City, or on some of the others, WPFW in Washington, our sister stations, 1 hour, but for some, 4 hours. I'm going to ask my engineer just to correct my audio coming into my, getting a hollow sound in my, thank you. Because it's a holiday today, we will be having probably a little bit of technical glitches here and there. That's better. Now we got it. I'm going to be sharing a lot of information. It's rare that I have 4 hours in which to be able to talk with people. But today, you can expect to see commentaries on the following issues. We're going to have commentaries on incipient fascist state. America Has Gone Away, by Professor Paul Craig Roberts. 19 facts about the deindustrialization of America that will blow your mind, from Michael Snyder. Information I can assure you that no one's talking about. Not the Tea Party group. No one is talking about this. So we're going to global poverty, food riots, and economic crisis. I'm going to ask the engineer to correct, please, again. I'm getting a feedback in my ear. So please correct the audio again. Sorry for the technical difficulty. Our normal engineer is not here. Also, America's culture of cruelty. This will surprise a lot of people, because I will be laying out how, when we call ourselves... No, engineer, please bring it down. I'm going to ask just for a second, ladies and gentlemen, so we can finally correct this. bring my down. We have a hollow echo sound in my headset, please. No, it's not. Bring it down. That's better. All right. Sorry, on a holiday, we do not have a regular team in, so we have... We're going to suffer through this for a few moments till we try to get it right. Apologize in advance. Anyhow, I have 4 hours for some of you to share insights. That's got it. Now just please leave it there and don't touch it. And I'm going to share insights from a wide variety of perspectives. I'm also going to be talking about preventing and treating influenza with natural medicine. The latest on natural estrogen replacement therapy that will help a lot of women in this audience who need natural estrogen therapy. Also, for those of you who thought that taking the anti-papilloma vaccine, Gardasil, would help you, it does not, but Coriolis does. It's a mushroom, and I'll give you the latest, and a very in-depth discussion of what in the world is in blueberries that could make an enormous difference that could help us? So you'll find all about blueberries in depth. Not all mushrooms are the same. How do you know that the mushroom extract you're using works? I'll explain to you how you can read a label and see If the reishi or ganoderma, what percentage of that is the actual beta-glucan, the polysaccharides? So how you read a label and know whether or not the label you're reading means that the product is going to help you or not. Don't just look at what's in it. You have to know what percentage is in it. And I'm also going to tell you, answer questions about beta-1,3-glucan and why it's so important for our immune systems at this time. As you can see, we have an enormous amount to share with you. But I got 4 hours to do it. At least some of you can hear that 4 hours. And everyone can always go to progressiveradionetwork.com to listen to the archives if you missed something. Let us, and my guest, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, is going to talk about scientific bias with emphasis upon pancreatic cancer and other cancer research approaches. And I'm going to begin with Dr. Gonzalez because of people in the audience asking me what happened when it comes to an Aretha Franklin or someone else like Steve Jobs of Apple who have pancreatic cancer. Isn't there some way to help them as well? Well, the answer is yes, if they pay attention to the information. If they're interested, if they wish to call, we'll give them information. They can speak directly with people about what's going on. Let me introduce my first guest today, in fact, my only guest today. Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez is a medical doctor. He's a board-certified physician, and he is an expert in alternative and nutritional approaches to treating cancer. He's also been a researcher in pancreatic enzyme therapy since the 1980s, and he has degrees from Brown University, Columbia University, and Cornell University. He also was a fellow under Dr. Robert Good, who, by the way, is considered the father of modern immunology at Sloan Kettering. His website is drgonzalez.com. The book is Trophoblast and the Origins of Cancer. Nice to have you with us today.
Gary, it's always such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me back again.
The reason that I invited you on was an article that I read in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients, which I publish in on a regular basis. And I hadn't read your articles, and there were two parts that I read. I don't know if there were more. And I just want to start with something that I read from the Townsend Letter. It was an article that was entitled, Some Thoughts About Scientific Bias. I'll just read a short piece of this. It says, this is from the second part, because this is what's really important. Moving on to the second great recent example of scientific fraud at the highest levels. And by the way, this is also a wake-up call for one of my recent guests who was on the show, and I suggested that there are little C conspiracies and there are big C conspiracies in science, in medicine, in public health, and she refused to accept that. She's just living in an altered reality. But a lot of these people who are afraid to acknowledge that vaccines have no actual gold standard for safety and efficacy, so they hedge their bets. Well, I'm not anti-vaccine, but, you know, maybe we should do more research, and maybe there's a connection between vaccines and autism, maybe vaccines and other conditions. Well, I have done the research, and there is no science. They have no gold standard, and the 22 studies they put forward are their standards. You could drive a truck through the sloppiness, all of which were created by the people who manufacture vaccines. And we have dissected those in a series of articles, Richard Gale and myself, that have gone viral. Millions and millions of people have read them. And yet the people who get funding, who run these little vaccine organizations, simply refuse to accept that vaccines do not have the gold standard. And yet the people in the field whose own children have been damaged refuse to acknowledge this. It's as if they're afraid to stand up to the power base. Now, that's my experience. That's their rights not to accept this. Even Dr. Wakefield, who on one level, I must tell you, I'm very disappointed in. Because when a man's been beaten, kicked, brutalized, mugged, stamped on, lost his medical license, disgraced in the world, you think he would come out swinging. You think he would say, let's go at it. You know, and it's beyond frustrating trying to help some of these people. And still, well, I'm not against vaccines. You know, I just wish you would stagger the vaccines. But, okay, Dr. Wakefield, show me, please, a single study that if you vaccinate a child with an individual measles, mumps, or rubella vaccine, that you have one group of children, 1,000 children that have not been vaccinated at all, one group just given the single vaccine, you study them over a 6-year period and see which group came down with what conditions and what percentages there were. Oh, you mean there is no such study? Well, if there's no such study, then why would you say they should have the single vaccines? This is what I'm dealing with. There's just this mind-numbingly terror, fear in the hearts of people, doctors, scientists, and a lot of activists. In any case, I don't want to digress, but this is where we get into this. So to the woman who was on my show, this is the Big C conspiracy. And it was brought to us by Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, my guest, who we have no rush, so I'm going to go to him in a moment. But I need to quote from him in order for you to know why I brought him on the show today. Quote, moving on to the second great recent example of scientific fraud at the highest levels. I have learned of the HIV nevirapine study in mid-2007 from my friend Robert Scott Bell, host of the national radio show devoted to alternative medicine issues, particularly the politics in the field. In recent years, I have appeared on his show several times to discuss the therapies, including the National Cancer Institute clinical trials, which had generated considerable interest within the alternative health world. In the spring of 2007, Robert, who normally hosted his show from a studio in Florida, happened to be in New York, attending a several-day conference on alternative medicine at the Hilton Hotel. He had set up a booth, and I was invited to talk. So we sat there, and we talked about the status of the clinical trial at that point under investigation by the Office of Human Research Protections. I arrived early before his show had gone on the air, and he and I talked for some time about the trial's disastrous turn. He seemed very disappointed, though not surprised, that the study had essentially fallen apart due to apparent mismanagement on the part of the conventional investigators assigned to supervise the project. As I regaled him with the evidence I had collected, he asked me if I had been following the scandalous revelations about the HIV nevirapine study conducted in Africa, a highly funded, highly lauded National Institutes of Health project testing the use of an anti-HIV drug to prevent the transmission of HIV from infected pregnant women to their babies. I had heard of the study and allegations of mismanagement as reported in the press, but I hadn't followed the issue closely. He explained that the project had apparently been so poorly supervised from its beginning that patients, both the women and their babies, had been put at risk, and that the evidence of wrongdoing on the part of the National Institutes of Health scientists had been deftly covered up and suppressed right up to the highest levels of the National Institutes of Health. When a National Institute of Health whistleblower, Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, tried to expose the mismanagement, he had been viciously attacked, then fired in retribution for his complaining. Fortunately, Robert informed me Congress had taken up the cause, listened to Dr. Fishbein, and in his own investigations vindicated his allegations. As a result, Dr. Fishbein had been reinstated at the National Institutes of Health. Robert thought that my situation sounded in some way similar to that faced by Dr. Fishbein, who found that regulatory agencies completely indifferent to evidence of serious mismanagement, scientific fraud, and corruption. After learning about the HIV nevirapine fiasco, Robert had contacted Dr. Fishbein and had then appeared on his radio several times to tell his story. Spurred on by Robert's revelations about HIV nevirapine trial, over the next few months, I began my own investigations into its history. What I found would leave me seriously questioning whether any of the oversight offices within the Department of Health and Human Services or the National Institutes of Health hierarchy had the competence, the motivation, or the simple integrity to aggressively investigate instances of scientific misconduct and fraud committed by their own. As I learned, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, a division of the National Institutes of Health, conducted the HIV nevirapine trial in Uganda from 1997-1999, under the direction of a group of esteemed international researchers. In this effort, the investigators hope to determine if the antiviral retroviral drug manufactured by the major pharmaceutical company administered to HIV-positive mothers and their babies after birth could prevent transmission of the virus. During and after the project, U.S. government spokespeople aggressively touted the trial as an exemplary example of U.S. efforts to help stem the tide of AIDS in Africa. The National Institutes of Health, excited about the very encouraging preliminary results, even released the data before its publication in the peer-reviewed literature, reporting an astonishing 48% decrease in HIV transmission with the drug compared to the group receiving a short course of the control, AZT, the previous standard approach to the problem of mother-infant transmission. Not only did the new regimen prove effective, the early documents claimed, but the treatment was easily administered, inexpensive, and with few reported side effects. On September 4, 1999, in the prominent international journal Lancet, the HIV Nevirapine team formally published the data to great acclaim, ushering in, they reported, a new era in HIV prevention, a major step in halting the massive epidemic of the disease in Africa. As a result of this study, in January 2001, Ugandan authorities approved the drug for use as a preventative against HIV transmission in the babies of HIV-positive women. Subsequently, in July 2001, the manufacturer submitted an application to the FDA seeking approval for use of the drug as a preventative for mother-baby transmission in the United States. However, by early 2002, scientists outside the National Institutes of Health began to question the initial enthusiastic reports of a great new advance against the HIV epidemic. In preparation for the required FDA review, an internal audit of the data by the manufacturer uncovered evidence of numerous and significant protocol irregularities that, as the official report stated, violated the integrity of the data from the trial that had been published in The Lancet. In response to manufacturers' concerns, an independent organization launched its own investigation. An article appeared in USA Today, 2005, discussing in detail the questions. Quote, Boehringer Ingelheim, the Connecticut-based company that makes Nevirapine, told the National Institute of Health it identified at least one critical compliance issue that compromised the integrity of the study and more than four dozen issues it described as serious and major. The manufacturers and the National Institutes of Health auditors cited concerns such as failing to get patients' consent about changes in the experiment, administering wrong doses, and delays in underreporting death and life-threatening problems. USA Today article then quoted an official report written by a private firm, Westat, contradicting the investigation. Quote, it appears likely, in fact, that many adverse events and perhaps a significant number of serious adverse events for both mother and infant may have not been collected or reported in a timely manner. Westat reported that there were 14 deaths not reported in the study database as early as 2002, and that the top two researchers in Uganda acknowledged, quote, thousands of bad reactions that were not disclosed. In March 2002, National Institute of Health officials began meeting for an apparent damage control, covered up, as USA Today reports. Quote, NI officials reviewed the bad news early March 2002. Meeting minutes, written in shorthand, raised broad concerns. Half the babies in the study were also enrolled in a vitamin A study at the same time that would have affected the outcome, and medical staff running the trials didn't follow procedures for divulging serious adverse events. Now, in March 2002, as the evidence of the mismanagement mounted, the manufacturer withdrew its application to the FDA. Despite the growing storm over the data, on June 19, 2002, President Bush unveiled his $500 million new mother and child HIV preventative initiative with none other than the drug Nevirapine, lauded as the showcase intervention, and stating that the U.S., quote, will support programs that administer a single dose of Nevirapine to the mother at the time of delivery and at least one dose to the infant shortly after. This major, quote, commitment of my government to prevent mother-to-child HIV transmission is the first of its scale by any government anywhere, unquote, Bush said. No one at the National Institute of Health had bothered to tell the president that the study was a fraud, a shambles. Its data questionable at best. National Institutes of Health officials fully aware that Boehringer's and its own audits deliberately kept the bad news from the White House. Quote, but the National Institutes of Health, the government premier health agency who chose not to inform the White House as it scrambled to keep its experts' concerns from scuttling the use of nevirapine in Africa as a cheap solution. In 2002, less than a month after the Bush announcement, the DHHS notified the Ugandan government that the once-lauded study had repeatedly violated its requirements for protection of research subjects. And finally here, it says, surprisingly, at times truth does come out on top. As the DAIDS scandal exploded in the press and as government investigations continued, finally in 2006, the National Institute of Health hierarchy was forced to reinstate Dr. Fishbein. And after I studied in some depth this fiasco, I spoke with Robert Bell several times about Dr. Fishbein and the harassment he had endured. Robert described Dr. Fishbein as a man of great idealism and obvious honor, qualities apparently quite rare among government scientists. Tragically, the vicious attacks that he suffered at the hands of his colleagues and superiors at the National Institute of Health have left him disillusioned and discouraged. The National Institute of Health not only ignored his honest and well-motivated concerns, but had sought to punish him for being so relentless in the pursuit of truth. After his firing, he doubted that he would work again in medicine, so determined was the National Institute of Health to destroy his credibility as a scientist. Despite Dr. Fishbein's reinstatement, Robert thought he would be viewed as a pariah, to be avoided at all costs. His future career at the National Institute of Health could hardly be a happy one. In the HIV nevirapine affair, my colleague Dr. Isaacs and I saw a warning of National Institute of Health incompetence and blatant corruption, a morality play of sorts about the perversion of scientific truth for personal and political gain at the highest levels of the federal research community. But as we were to learn, the HIV nevirapine trial was far more in terms of our own clinical study than just a cautionary tale. As it turns out, sometime before the scandal broke in the press, the supervisor of the study, Dr. Jack Killen, had very quietly been moved to the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, where he had been placed in charge of my project without a word to me about his previous experiences within the National Institutes of Health. And now, having helped manage not one but two highly watched federal studies that collapsed in chaos, he had been rewarded with a promotion that he was given. And that's where I will stop the reading of my guest, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez's series of articles, Some Thoughts About Scientific Bias, that we have put up on GaryNall.com and ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I wanted to take the time to read these verbatim. Why? Because there is virtually no legitimate science about the true multi-causes of AIDS, nor the true multi-causes of cancer, or heart disease, or other conditions in our society. And for those scientists, public health officials, activists, or journalists who choose to see the truth and bring it to attention inside federal agencies, without exception, they are dealt with in this manner as Dr. Fishbein was, but when it came to exposing the dangers in advance of Vioxx, as Dr. Graham did inside the FDA, as he told me in person when we filmed him, he was not just a pariah, he was threatened, intimidated, and bribed. So my question is, for you, Dr. Gonzalez, to begin this, before we go into your clinical trials and your experience trying to show that your therapy has helped terminal cancer patients, including pancreatic cases, where you've had patients reverse and be cured of pancreatic cancer. And this is the message to go out to Aretha Franklin, to go out to everyone. And Steve Jobs, as smart as he is, he surrounded himself with people who may not have this knowledge, and therefore we're giving him the benefit of knowing this. You too were set upon. Your study was intentionally with malice aforethought. It was scuttled. Tell us your story, please.
Giving me the opportunity to talk about it. Interestingly enough, just last night on Dateline at NBC, they were talking about our clinical study. They did a, you know, what I think is a hatchet job. But the study is kind of interesting. You know, alternative doctors like myself get accused of not being transparent, as they said on Dateline. We've been transparent from the beginning, as you know, and as you said when you introduced me. I have a very conventional research background. 3 Ivy League schools, did my fellowship under the most published author in the history of medicine, Robert Good. I was trained to do bone marrow transplants. You can't get more orthodox than that. But I had an open mind, so when I was a medical student doing my research, I began to look at nutrition and cancer, and I read your original articles, and I think they were in Our Town, one of the first series of articles published on alternative cancer when you talked about the eminent Dr. Ravisi. And I remember those articles when I was a medical student. And my goal, as trained as a conventional researcher after I had finished my research fellowship, was to get this research properly checked and investigated. And in 1993, I presented to the National Cancer Institute as one of their first efforts to try and look into alternative therapies. And I will say there were people at that meeting that had a very open mind. You know, not everyone at NIH is corrupt. Maybe most, but not everyone. And as a result of that presentation, they suggested I do a pilot study with pancreatic cancer. They suggested I take on pancreatic cancer because, as you know and suggested earlier, it's the most aggressive cancer in medicine with an average survival still today after 50 years of research in the range of 3 to 6 months. They wanted me to take on 10 patients with advanced pancreatic cancer, and this was a preliminary phase 2 study without a control group just to see if anyone responded. And Dr. Michael Friedman, who was then associate director of the NCI, said if I could get 3 patients to live 1 year, he would consider that extraordinary. Well, Nestle funded the study. We had funding from industry, interestingly enough. And in 1999, we presented the results, and we had 5 patients that lived more than 2 years. We had 2 patients that lived beyond 4 years, one that lived 5 years and died of a heart attack. And these were patients with advanced cancer. And the reason he died of a heart attack is he went off his nutrition. We had results that had never been reported in the history of medicine. As a result of that, the NCI, around 1998, when the preliminary results of our pilot study were first coming forward, suggested we do a large-scale study. And the head of the NCI at that time, Richard Klausner, met with me personally, eye-to-eye, face-to-face, down at Congressman Burton's office in Washington. And I believed absolutely that he wanted to do a fair study. He believed the results of the pilot study were so good that this warranted a fair investigation, even if, you know, his training was somewhat different than what I did, which is all nutritional. Based on that, he approved a controlled trial without even our having to fill out a formal grant at that point. We eventually had to fill out the paperwork, but he approved the grant before we even filled out the paperwork based on the pilot study results. And Columbia University agreed to be the center, which was my first mistake. Again, thinking that everyone was going to finally work together. You know how naive I was, Gary. I wish I had your experience at that point. But I was so idealistic going back 13, 12 years that I thought this was the greatest thing. We finally had an opportunity to test an unconventional treatment in an academic setting with a group of serious alternative and conventional scientists working for the benefit of mankind. Unfortunately, from the beginning, there were problems. And it was, you know, initially, I think it was more just naivete. They tried, I guess that must be my line, and we tried to block, I'm speaking to you from home. We tried to, you know, set it up so that it would be appropriately tested, but they were trying to set up a protocol as if this were chemotherapy. And, of course, our therapy involves individualized diets, supplements, coffee enemas, detoxification routines that the patients have to do at home. So it's a self-administered program, unlike chemo, but the way the protocol was set up, they wanted it set up so it was like we were testing chemotherapy, and that was the problem. One of the biggest issues is they insisted on an intent-to-treat provision in the protocol, which we argued, Dr. Isaacson and my colleague argued against. Intent-to-treat is sometimes used in clinical trials, and what it means is as soon as a patient is entered into the study, even if they never do the treatment, they're considered as treated. And we said this is preposterous for a nutritional program, and that, you know, we're held hostage to the patient's compliance, and not everyone who goes on this program is going to do it. But they insisted that had to be the case because that's what they use for chemo. Of course, it added a great bias against us, as we were to learn. The second issue, initially we were allowed to be involved in the selection of patients, but then the geniuses at the NCI thought that that would add a bias. So we were eliminated from any any involvement in the selection of patients was all put under the supervision of John Chabot, Chief of General Surgery at Columbia. He was going to be the person in charge of selecting the patients. Now, it was set up so our therapy would be compared to the best available chemotherapy, and that sounds like a pretty fair thing. What we didn't know at the time is Dr. Chabot had been involved in developing the chemo regimen that was being used against us.
That's a direct conflict of interest.
Direct. It's so unsubtle.
That's unpalpable. That's with a large C. You cannot have a person who's in competition with chemotherapy to treat the same cancers then judging or overseeing your study using natural therapies. That should have rung a big bell somewhere.
Well, we didn't know he was involved. It was kept from us. Now, whether, again, the people at the NCI and the NIH knew this and kept it from us, I don't know. It's inconceivable to me that the NCI and the NIH would not be aware that Chabot had been involved in the development of the very chemo regimen that was being used against us. To use the word conflict of interest, we have to invent a new word because this is such an egregious conflict of interest. The word conflict of interest doesn't do it justice.
How about a very romantic word? Utter stupidity.
Yeah, at least I can laugh about it now. So we were held hostage to that, and what's so ironic is we were eliminated from being involved in any vote in patient selection because we might add a bias. I mean, they gave unilateral, dictatorial, total, complete selection authority to the person who was involved at Columbia developing the chemo regimen. See, initially, we didn't even realize that the chemo regimen that was being used against it had been developed at Columbia. We thought it was a generic chemo regimen that all doctors use. We only learned through our own investigation that this was a specific Columbia regimen that had been developed at Columbia with Chabot's participation. So the fact that he had a conflict of interest apparently bothered nobody. We didn't learn about this until years later, that his conflict of interest developed and matured during the time of our chemo study. We realized this was a great opportunity for him to get a lot of publicity for his own personal chemo regimen. Of course, that would involve making sure the chemo regimen worked better than our therapy. One of the things that, again, he was in total charge that happened is he began to enter patients for nutritional treatment with us that we believe did not meet the entry criteria of the protocol. Patients who were so sick they couldn't possibly do our therapy. We had patients that were sent to us for treatment who couldn't eat. And we had a patient who was dead within a couple of weeks, never even got a supplement order, never even took the supplements. But because of the intent to treat provision, which I mentioned earlier, each patient who was sent to us, as soon as they entered into our office, they were considered as treated, even if they never took a single supplement. Ultimately, the nutrition arm, the arm that we were involved in treating, was filled with patients who either never did it partially or completely, or couldn't do it. We estimate out of the 39 patients that were ultimately entered for treatment with us, maybe five or six did it at all, maybe three or four did it completely, and they were very long-term survivors. Yet all the patients who didn't do it or quit to go to chemo or couldn't do it, who died too quickly and died before they even got the supplement orders, were considered as Gonzales treatment failures by the way that the protocol was set up. Now, why did we allow that intent to treat provision? Dr. Isaacs and I, my colleague and I, were so idealistic that we were willing to compromise for the benefit of science, thinking that if they did it at least partially fairly, we would still be victorious. And had they done it partially fairly, based on our own clinical experience and our practice, we would have been victorious. But when they sent us patients who were so sick that we would never even consider treating them in our private practice, there was no way to override that. And as the trial progressed, the patients they sent to us became what we believe more and more inappropriate. Fortunately, often with arrogance goes laziness. We began to realize that we had a weapon we could use. Chabot was sending us patients that we learned had not been properly consented. Now, that's a very serious thing. Informed consent is required by law. It's required for any federally funded clinical trial, and it has to be written informed consent. In fact, informed consent for research studies comes out of the Nuremberg trials where the Nazis did all kinds of egregious experiments on humans. It is such an important issue involving clinical research that even the UN and the World Health Organization have trumpeted in on this issue, and they have strict regulations internationally about proper informed consent. Well, Chabot, who was in charge of all entry of patients and in charge of informed consent, was sending us patients who weren't consented. Now, he had no vested interest in doing that. That's just pure carelessness. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension. We discovered this. Again, the geniuses at the NCI and the NIH who were supervising the study didn't discover it, just as they didn't tell us about the conflict of interest. Dr. Isaacs and I discovered that patients were not being sent to us, were being sent to us without proper informed consent, which is a serious issue, a violation of the written protocol for this particular study, a violation of federal law and government regulations. We filed a complaint. We, the fringe alternative doctors, filed a complaint with the Office of Human Research Protections, which is the oversight group at the Department of Health and Human Services, responsible for the oversight of federally funded clinical studies and their proper management. Now, I imagine down there in Washington, the OHRP, as they're known, Office of Human Research Protections, would have been, you know, they're all conventional scientists, would have thought a complaint from an alternative doctor, probably sour grapes or whatever. But we provided so much documentation on the specific informed consent issue that they launched an investigation, I guess it was 2006, and eventually took two years to complete, government bureaucracy being what it is. At the end of that, they found that Chabot had entered 32 out of a total of 62 patients had been improperly admitted into the study, which I was told, and I don't know if this is true, that was a record for inappropriate admissions to a federally funded study. Despite that, Chabot still tried to publish an article first in the Journal of the American Medical Association without, even though we were part of the study, he tried to publish an article without my knowledge, telling the editor at JAMA that we had quit the study. That's why I wasn't a co-author. The editor of JAMA, the oncology editor, who was a very honorable guy, didn't suspicious about that, called me on a Sunday night and told me that he had an article in front of him from Dr. Chabot about how my therapy didn't work and chemo was superior, and claiming that this was a very perfectly run study with no flaws and no mistakes. I almost dropped dead. He called me on a late Sunday night. He said there was something about the article that made him suspicious. He knew nothing about the fact that the Office of Human Research Protection at that point had completed, was involved in a study, but of the trial, had already found that patients were being improperly admitted. He didn't know anything about that. JAMA, of course, rejected the article. To my astonishment, Chabot was still able to get the article published eventually in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, which has a history of publishing fraudulent articles. And that article is in the medical literature now, basically claiming that our therapy doesn't work. In his article, there's no mention of the fact that a government oversight committee, the Office of Human Research Protections, conducted an in-depth two-year investigation and found that he had inappropriately admitted 32 out of 62 patients. In fact, so serious was the inappropriate admission of so many patients that the government required Chabot and his team undergo retraining for research methodology. Believe me, for a division head at a major Ivy League medical center, that's quite a slap on the wrist to have to undergo retraining in research methodology. It's all on their website. None of this is secret, the fact that he had to undergo retraining. Despite that, he was still able to get the article published, and the enemies of alternative medicine are using that article to prove that the alternative doctors don't know what they're doing. In fact, this is the whole irony of the story, is Dr. Isaacs and I, quote, the fringe alternative doctors, end quote, are the ones that really were determined that this trial be run properly. We're the ones that constantly had to make sure that the study was running the way it was supposed to run, that patients would be admitted according to the requirements of the written protocol, and they were not being admitted that way. We're the ones that had to find out patients were being sent to us without the required written consent. We're the ones that had to find out that many patients that had been admitted did not meet the written criteria of the protocol. And despite that, the NCI and the NIH did nothing. They allowed them to publish.
Okay,
so that's where we stand.
Okay.
That's the summary of our clinical study.
All right. I needed the people in this audience to hear this for a simple reason. When we bring forward people who have been improved, helped to major degrees, or even cured of autism, cancers, Alzheimer's, advanced Alzheimer's, as has been multiple sclerosis, then they go to their doctor, they look up online, or they go to Wikipedia and these other corrupt places, and they say, oh, it's not possible, where's their clinical studies? Long ago, I learned that everything is about the big C and small C when it comes to government. I wish that what we're seeing now in Egypt and the Middle East, we saw here in the United States and completely deconstructed and eliminated the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, National Institute of Mental Health. Virtually every major health agency should be abolished from the face of the earth, and in its place, independent science based upon cause and effect of what causes illnesses and what can treat them. Right now, here is the results that you wouldn't know. Quote from Dr. Anthony Apostolidis, MD, PhD from Harvard, the United States Program on Cancer, 1975 to 2006, a 21-year review. I have every single year We have made no improvement at all. We have had a massive failure. Every year it shows the percentage of people getting cancer, the number of people getting cancer, and the number per 10,000 getting cancer. And it was only 1 year where it leveled off, 2 years where it leveled off, but still it didn't go down. And here is the conclusion at the end of this piece, and this should have been, by the way, mainstream publications, major expose, 60 Minutes, everyone should have been on this. Cancer mortality, mortality rate of cancer, quote, those who are diagnosed with cancer, a significant number unfortunately succumb to the disease and die, often with considerable suffering. And then they go through to show how many the number is. And when I look down here at the total number, it is, quote, 0.28 decrease. That's not even one-third of 1% per year. But the total number is what's staggering. Are you ready for how many people tried only orthodox therapy and died, only cancer radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery and died, who never tried any alternative therapy, who trusted completely? Listen carefully. This is from this actual article with graphs, study reports, etc. Quote, over the period of 1975 to 2006, the total number of Americans who were afflicted with cancer reached close to 38 million. In the last 10-year period, from 1997 to 2006, the total number of people who were afflicted reached close to 14 million. This most recent period has the largest annual numbers of Americans contracting cancer over this period of time. Now, with almost 500,000 dying per year, that's almost 4.5 million dead Americans. When you're closing on 5 million Americans dying, 5 million, and no one questions the institutes that are overseeing it, the President's Cancer Advisory Board, which, by the way, Robert Hughes and I were the first two journalists in American history to expose the corruption of that organization in a series of articles called Medical Genocide in 1976, 1977, right up through, and showed the suppression of alternative cancer therapies. But on the one hand, the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC, everyone in the field is terrified to even suggest, much like the apologists for the vaccine industry, well, yeah, my kid got autism, and yeah, my kid's brain dead, and yeah, my kid's got gastrointestinal problems, but we're not opposed to vaccines. Well, why in the hell aren't you opposed to vaccines? Why are you afraid to stand up? Why are we afraid to stand up to these oncologists and these cancer doctors and the research institutes and say, hey, fellas, you killed 5 million Americans. That's medical genocide. You're getting all the money. The alternative doctors who are saving lives get no money. You get all the publication. You control everything. You control the media. You control funding. You control Congress. You control the legislators. You control the front organizations. You control the walks for breast cancer. You control the biking and all these people. And yet when it comes to someone actually coming forward and saying, test my therapy, I've got 5 patients who are alive and well from end-stage pancreatic cancer who are healthy today, you have zero. So test me. And Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez makes that challenge, and they intentionally, I believe in malice forethought, they subvert his study, and then the Quackbusters and WikiLeaks. And by the way, if you doubt me for a second that WikiLeaks is fully in the power of the pharmaceutical cartels and their front groups and the Quackbusters, change anything on any of the profiles and see within seconds how it's changed back. That can't be by normal circumstance. That's by people who are manipulating public perception, because in America, if you control perception, you control people's reality. If you say Nicholas Gonzalez's therapy didn't work and there's an article published in a peer-reviewed journal and your oncologist with complete and typical arrogance and self-righteousness says, I can't offer you a chance to do this therapy, I'd be risking your life. And I have to give you proven therapies. Otherwise, we're in unproven therapies. You would not know. Well, hold on, sir. 5 million Americans tried your proven therapies and they're all dead. You have no one with advanced pancreatic cancer you can show is alive and well and cancer-free 5 years later. One man has five, and there are other doctors that also have patients. And the therapy that he was brought forward, his trial was sabotaged, and we have evidence of it. But no one will look for the truth. Those are my thoughts. I'll give you final thoughts on this.
Well, we have lots of patients with pancreatic cancer in our private practice that have lived beyond 5, even 10 years. My longest survivor was one of my first patients when I opened up my practice. 22 years out now, going on 23 years with pancreatic cancer. Tumors went away within a year on our therapy, and she's doing fine. I get a Christmas card from her. We've had patients with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, all biopsy proven by the standards of conventional medicine. These are people with real pancreatic cancer, not diagnosed by a psychic. Live 5, 10, 15 years later, even more. And these are the kind of cases I've presented to the NCI with apparent indifference. So we know the therapy works, and I agree with everything you said. I think the problem with conventional medicine, well, it's twofold. First, there's an enormous financial incentive. I mean, I've heard figures that chemotherapy brings in $100 billion a year. I mean, there are drugs that, well, single drug alone can bring in $2, $3 billion a year. These are very lucrative drugs, and our therapy is reasonably inexpensive, and it's not patentable. That's the first problem. The second thing is we live in an irreligious time, and people don't, you know, really respect anything, government, religion, Orthodox religion, the legal profession. The only remaining religion is conventional Orthodox science, and it really is a religion. You know, they have their institutions, their temples, like Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson. They wear special clothes, the white jackets. They have their own language that the rest of us can't understand. It's all mystical, very mysterious. And we all think that these are the smartest people from high school that were kind of intimidated. Now these are the geniuses running medicine. And the most skeptical, hard-nosed journalist who wouldn't believe anything a politician or a lawyer said, if it comes out of Sloan Kettering, it's like they roll over and die and worship it. That somehow conventional medicine, conventional medical research, the NCI, the NIH, these are the remaining temples in our culture that are inviolate, that no one questions them not for a second. And it's, I think it's almost irrational. It's like the need for humans to believe in something bigger than themselves. And there's nothing left except conventional science, this mysterious phenomena that we have in our culture, that it's so all these brilliant people working for the truth. Of course, just, you know, that
if Sloan Kettering were run by as a temple of wise men and women, then they shouldn't need a morgue.
That's right.
They should ascend to health. They do not.
You know,
they have a terrible record, but it's all illusion. If you sell people the illusion of success, it's like Lady Gaga. The 60 Minutes, shame on Anderson Cooper for a lot of things, including calling himself a journalist. But the worst off is to promote someone as if their success is what we should focus on. If she really isn't intimidated, if she really is not coming from fear, then let her go out in front of an audience with nothing but regular clothes, no backup singers, backup dancers, flash and dash, and simply sing and see if she has the charisma like Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Lena Horne, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, to mesmerize a group. If she can do that, then she deserves to be acknowledged for her talent. If she can't, then she's a manufacturer. Pure 100% M&M illusion, pretending to have talent when they don't. And that's our culture today. People pretending to have knowledge, they don't. People pretending having miracle cures, they don't. Pretending to be the orthodox view of what we should base everything on, the gold standard, we don't. It is all a fraud. And if you open your eyes one day and you see it for what it is, then you will pay attention to looking for the truth, and the truth is never in our official institutions. For everyone,
never.
There's Orthodox religions. I'll show you 100 million dead who believe that Orthodox religion's God's voice was leading them to slay those who were non-believers. We're out of time. I look forward to you coming back on the air with our next visit, not to talk about the politics, which we were intending to today, but to bring your patients and let your patients tell the story of how they're alive and well today. And Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, Roswell Park, the Cleveland Clinic cannot bring a single patient with end-stage pancreatic cancer 5 years later, cancer-free, to sit across from them and tell them about the miracles of their chemotherapy, their radiation, repeatedly. But your patients will be here to tell that story, all right?
That would be great. I look forward to it.
Give your number out, please.
My office is 212-213-3337. 212-213-3337.
We're going to be back with Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez within the next week or two to hear from his patients, long-term cures with pancreatic cancer, but you need the totality. If I just brought on the patients to talk about their therapy, the moment you tell your doctor and Steve Jobs, his people are going to tell him, the best and the brightest, the ones who are on the 20th floor in a 10-floor building where you have to ascend up through ethereal vapors to reach the high oncology man, you're going to have to know the politics of the reality that this is a battle. And Nicholas Gonzalez is in trench warfare. In one of those dirty World War I trenches, he's allowing his patients a chance to know the truth. The rest of us are not seeing this for what it is. We glamorize it, and then we proselytize it, and we make illusion our reality, and then we all live by the myth that we've got a noble cause. We look at the results? Never. We look at the effort? Only. I'm Gary Null. That's my point of view. Thank you very much, Nicholas Gonzalez.
Thank you, Gary. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
In a moment, for those of you listening over our WMYN and other stations and the Progressive Radio Network, I'm going to take on the Federal Reserve's idea that we should go to a zero backup money in the bank, meaning banks shouldn't have to have any reserves. They can just print money with nothing to back it up, and that what they're doing is going to help us, Main Street. They're liars. You'll hear that. And then Ralph Nader, finally. Good for you, Ralph. After 35 years of telling you about the dangers of fluoride, he finally got it, and you'll hear from him.